Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
How much does medical care cost? Governor Rick Scott thinks everyone should know.
And what's it going to cost to see a doctor? What's it going to cost to get a procedure? The truth is we ought to be able to do that with all of our health care.
Also tonight, Florida Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater is leaning on the legislature to strengthen the state's economic sanctions against Iran as President Barack Obama prepares to lift the national sanctions.
Florida is not going to try to make a return on an invested dollar in companies that are supporting a regime that is committed to destroying the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel, and to be at war with America.
We'll also get an update on the future of Florida's infamous Dozier School for Boys, as well as the future of the state's burgeoning craft distilling industry. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Governor Rick Scott is pushing for greater health care cost transparency in hospitals. Len Hatter reports the move comes as Florida faces the loss of more federal health care funding next year and growing concerns about the state's health care costs.
Scott and hospitals have been at odds all year. Now the governor is accusing them of price gouging patients. The governor founded one of the largest hospital chains in the United States, but when asked how he's dealt with price transparency, Scott points instead to his urgent care company.
Put all the prices up on the menu board, just like Starbucks or anything else. You can just walk in, and what's it going to cost to see a doctor? What's it going to cost to get a procedure? The truth is we ought to be able to do that with all of our health care.
Urgent care centers have been posting prices for years now, but not every health care entity is transparent about its costs. Recently, Republican Representative Jason Brodeur cited cost differences in procedures between hospitals and other centers as he endorsed an extension of ambulatory care.
The average charge for a colonoscopy by site was $4,800 at a hospital-based facility and $2,000 at an ambulatory surgical center.
And the state recently announced health insurance rates would rise an average of 10%. Health policy analyst Greg Mello says there's no way to understand what factored into those decisions.
Claiming that information like that is subject to trade secret protection and so doesn't have to be disclosed to the public is a huge, is a huge disappointment. And it's sort of undermines the message that they want consumers to be aware and informed.
A report from the nonprofit Catalyst for Payment Reform gives Florida, along with the majority of other states, an F when it comes to health care cost transparency. The group's Andrea Caballero spoke to the Governor's Commission on Hospital and Healthcare Funding.
Variation in the prices really doesn't have much rationality to it. You can see prices in the U.S. for various services can vary as much as 700%. And when you compare the price variation to, are you getting 700% worth of higher quality? Not likely.
The commission is also concerned about a long-running issue, balance billing. That happens when patients get a bill for services not fully covered by their insurer. 3 years ago, a plan in the Florida legislature would have made it far easier to find out what health care services cost. The proposal brought by future House Speaker Richard Corcoran would have expanded a state requirement that certain providers post prices of common procedures. But it was killed in the Senate and opposed by the powerful Florida Medical Association. The bill would have applied to hospitals, ambulatory care centers, diagnostic imaging businesses, and doctors who work in hospital settings. All are places where patients can get unexpected bills. Much of it comes from when patients have to go to the emergency room, and the average consumer may not know whether a provider is in or out of network. Hospital Commissioner Eugene Lamb says he's had that experience.
My mother-in-law went to the hospital. She's 97 years old. And she stayed overnight. And when we knew that, then she had a bill for $12,000. And we was kind of surprised it cost so much.
The Florida Hospital Association says it agrees there should be more transparency in the system. And the organization's president, Bruce Rubin, says it should be easier for consumers to find out what services cost. But he says the way Governor Rick Scott has gone about placing blame on hospitals is wrong.
We're very disappointed with the mean-spirited tone of this press release that calls for protection against hospital pricing. It's discouraging when we have been working on our own proposal for increased transparency around price and clinical performance.
The governor's hospital transparency plan would require hospitals to post prices and average payments on their websites. Scott also wants patients to be able to pursue complaints of hospital price gouging with law enforcement and regulators. The FHA says it supports many of the governor's ideas, but they disagree with his characterizations. Florida lawmakers could expand the governor's plan to include other health care providers. The discussion comes as the state faces the loss of even more federal health care funding and expects Medicaid costs, which are one of the biggest parts of Florida's budget, to continue rising. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
President Barack Obama has his foreign policy objectives and Florida has its. Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater is leaning on the Florida legislature to strengthen the state's economic sanctions against Iran, just as Obama prepares to lift America's trade restrictions against the Mideastern nation. Jim Ash has that story.
Florida is not going to try to make a return on an investment dollar in companies that are supporting a regime that is committed to destroying the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel, and to be at war with America.
That's pretty harsh language for Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater, considered one of the most easygoing and likable political figures in Tallahassee. If it makes him sound more like a U.S. senator, maybe it's because he's considering a run. Atwater swears there's no connection. In fact, his vitriol against Iran dates back to 2007 when he was a lawmaker. Atwater led the drive to drop $1.1 billion in state pension fund investments in companies tied to the pariah nation. But the law gives the president and Congress the power to override the sanctions, and now that Obama has struck a deal with Iran, Atwater wants the loophole closed.
This is not something political. It's not something that has come up that has been raised just on recent political fighting that is taking place in Washington. It has been historic. Florida was the leader. We believe we helped divert resources that were going to go to this regime.
When it comes to punishing outlaw nations, Florida can swing a pretty big sledgehammer. The Florida retirement system was worth about $146 billion, that's with a B, at the end of last year. It earned a 17% return for its investors, making it an attractive vehicle. But taking the moral high ground comes with a cost. In the 1990s, Florida sold off most of its tobacco stocks, and the result was a financial debacle. The state lost hundreds of millions of dollars. Pension managers have been watching the stocks they had to sell off when Atwater sanctions took effect. Many of them were tied to oil companies. State Board of Administration senior manager Michael McCauley says the losses were comparatively low.
You could say, had we not had that restriction, that policy limitation, the FRS on kind of an unconstrained basis would have had an investment return of about $38 million higher.
Whether it's legal for Florida to continue its economic sanctions may be another matter. An Atwater spokeswoman says based on the structure of the Iran deal, there's no question. But Florida State University constitutional law professor Mark Seidenfeld isn't so sure. He says foreign policy is usually reserved for the president. However, some appellate courts have given states more leeway when it comes to investing.
The problem would be it wouldn't be really an investment decision. It would really be a symbolic statement by the state, but it is its own money.
Obama promised Iran to pressure the 25 states with economic sanctions to drop them. In Florida, the legislature is going to have to decide again. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a judge denies a request for an injunction against a planned Florida bear hunt, leaving some to wonder how the hunt will be stopped once it gets started.
You can't just, you know, blow a loud horn and everybody hears it because people are scattered deep into the woods.
Some are weighing in on what they'd like to see happen to the grounds of the old Dozier School for Boys, a former reform school with a troubled past.
We know there are bodies on the white site. I would ask that nothing ever be done with that property other than maybe a state park or a memorial to all of the kids that died there.
And a minor change in the state's liquor laws is redounding to the benefit of craft distillers.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by CGI, a partner to government and industry delivering built-for-government information technology solutions for nearly 40 years. CGI, committed to providing IT results Florida can count on. Details on the web at cgi.com.
Florida's first bear hunt in decades is scheduled to start near the end of October. It's a move wildlife officials say will help to control the animal's population. But Regan McCarthy reports activists allege in a court case the hunt is evidence the agency is failing to follow its duty under the state constitution to protect wildlife.
About 40 people signed up through a Facebook event to protest the state's bear hunt. The plan was to meet after a hearing to get an injunction blocking the hunt while the courts considered the case's constitutional argument. But after Leon Circuit Judge George Reynolds denied the request for an injunction, just a small handful of protesters showed up.
Well, we're sad.
That's Matthew Schwartz, executive director of the South Florida Wildlands Association.
It looked, for a while, like things were going in a good direction.
And while the effort fizzled, many involved say they're not ready to give up. One area Schwartz and others opposed to the hunt are raising as a concern is the number of hunting permits sold. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission is limiting the hunt to just 320 bears, with more specific limits based on region. But more than 2,000 hunters have purchased permits.
They could have started a lot slower. Like, for example, if you're going to have a quota of, I think it was 80 bears in the south area. So issue 80 permits and see how it goes.
Hunt protesters are concerned once the hunters start shooting, it will be difficult to stop them, even once that 320-bear limit has been met. And that's something Judge Reynolds questioned commission officials about in court.
If you give it any thought, you can't just, you know, blow a loud horn and everybody hears it because people are scattered deep into the woods.
Right. Yeah.
But that's something the FWC's Director of Hunting and Game Management, Diane Eggman, says the commission can handle. She says the commission will deploy what she calls a focused law enforcement effort during the week of the hunt. And she says once the hunt reaches its limit, the FWC has a plan in place for communicating that to hunters.
We'll make the information, the data about whether it's open or closed available through email addresses that we have. We will text it to hunters who provide their cell phone numbers. We'll post it on social media. And we'll have a phone hotline for them to call in to determine it also.
Another issue protesters have raised concerns about is the accuracy of the bear population numbers, which have been extrapolated from an old count. But FWC officials say the bear population was large enough, even when the old count was conducted, to warrant a hunt. Meanwhile, the FWC has announced plans to request that revenue brought in from the sale of hunting permits be used to help subsidize the purchase of bear-proof trash cans in communities with large bear populations. One of the main reasons bears are coming out of the woods and into neighborhoods is because they're drawn by the smell of food. FWC officials say using bear-proof trash cans will help to reduce human-bear conflicts and reduce the number of bears that must be euthanized because they've come to associate humans with food. But back outside the courthouse, Julie Watkins, executive director of the Girls Gone Green, says that doesn't change her mind about the hunt.
How do you kill a species in order to save a species? Conservation, it's not killing. We only have 3,000 bears. 3,000 bears, 19 to 20 million people. It doesn't make any sense that we can't find room for them. We really do need to learn just to coexist with our wildlife.
And Watkins points out that money hasn't been appropriated yet. Meanwhile, while the hunt is scheduled to continue, so is the court case. Lawyers for the animal rights group behind the case have said they're prepared to take it to the state's Supreme Court. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The Florida Cabinet, as well as stakeholders involved in the issue, are reviving a discussion about what should be done with the now-defunct Dozier School for Boys, which is surrounded by allegations of abuse and deaths over the course of a century. We get that story from Sasha Cordner.
As a youngster, Charles Fudge was sent to the Florida School for Boys, or what's now known as the Dozier School for Boys, for a year. The 67-year-old says he was an accessory to his brother taking money out of a lady's purse while they were mowing yards. He recalls two particular staffers beating him when he was 12.
Within the first 30 days that I was there, I was taken down to what they call the White House, and I was beaten 31 licks with a leather strap by Mr. Hatton. Another boy named Robert Strasberg was with me at the same time, and he got 33 licks from Troy Tidwell with the same strap.
And he says the hurt and humiliation didn't stop there.
We were made to lay on a cot with our head buried in a pillow and hold the rails on the cot. And if we didn't do that, they would call kitchen boys over to come help hold us down while they were beating us.
Fudge says his life since then included three failed marriages and a 3-year stint in prison when he was a teenager.
It's affected my life mentally and emotionally.
Losing
my brother at 24 years old, committing suicide, it's sad. And I know it all stems from the abuse that he took and the things that they did to him when he was there.
Fudge attended a recent Florida cabinet meeting with one of his surviving brothers to talk about the future of the Dozier grounds. Florida Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater had put that item on the agenda. Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam says some buildings on the property are beyond repair.
But then in the middle, you've also got a giant school that could easily be put back into service for the community. A magnificent recreational facility that could easily be rehabbed and put into service for this community, or things that begins to write a very different future than what that land has seen in the last three generations.
Other public speakers, like the NAACP's Dale Landry, weighed in as well. He talked about making sure there are funds to help families who want to rebury their loved ones whose remains have been identified.
We need to look at how we may repurpose that land. Not resell it, repurpose it to do something good.
While Fudge is in favor of a memorial, he says there is another graveyard on what's seen as the white side of the Boot Hill Cemetery, and he believes a team of University of South Florida researchers are out of funds to finish their work.
I don't agree totally with Mr. Putnam, but I'm sure that, you know, that property, until they find the remaining bodies, they should never let any kind of buildings be put on that property.
But Erin Kermely, the lead USF researcher, says while it's up to the cabinet to decide, she feels satisfied with the work her and her team have done so far. 2 years after the school closed down in 2011, Kermely and her team had started searching for boys' remains. Of the 51 found, she's identified 6 so far and hopes to ID another 10 soon using DNA.
And I think that we've found and done everything that we can in terms of field work. So right now we're really focused on trying to identify those that we have found. And there's a lot still to be done with trying to get those children named.
And while others have called it a bit premature, Atwater feels it was a very productive discussion.
Archiving, displaying artifacts, telling the story, being sure the story is very open. And I think you heard today how people, well, do we need more information? There's going to be very different opinions on what should be done with the property.
In January, Kermely and her team are expected to have a final report ready for the Florida Cabinet. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
This spring's Florida Standards Assessment was plagued by technical glitches, and some questions didn't align with state standards. Florida's accountability system uses the test results to determine school grades, teacher pay, and student promotions. But as Kate Payne reports, educators say it's time to reevaluate.
The test was rife with problems even before it was administered. Teachers said they weren't ready and worried students weren't comfortable with the new technology nor the new learning standards. Technical glitches meant thousands of students struggled to complete their exams. A recent review of the Florida Standards Assessment found it valid, but questions remain on how the result will impact Florida schools. But the Association of Superintendents, Florida PTA, and Florida School Board Association agree. They have no confidence in school accountability. Students will not be penalized for poor scores this year, but the same scores will be used to determine school grades. For Florida School Board's Andrea Messina, this doesn't add up.
What makes sense to parents and what makes sense to the community at large and to educators is if the test is not valid for individual students, how then can it be applied in the aggregate?
Individual superintendents have publicly criticized the test and its role in the accountability system. Leon County Superintendent Jackie Pond says teachers shouldn't be penalized for poor scores either.
We're not going to use any of these test scores in order to give any teacher a punitive or negative evaluation based on data that's, not correct in a testing environment that wasn't where students didn't have the opportunity to show, what they had actually learned during the year.
Meanwhile, the Superintendents Association at large wants to forego issuing school grades this year. Superintendent Association Director and State Senator Bill Montford says poor school grades for incomplete student scores will further erode confidence in the system.
If a school receives a grade of an F, whether or not there's a monetary penalty to that or not, there's still a penalty because that has far-reaching implications, not only for the students and for the teachers, but the community as well.
But Senate Education Chief John Legg says that some schools should take a good look at test results.
We have some counties very close to Tallahassee, not Leon County, but right next to Leon County, where almost 40% of the students are scoring in the bottom quartile, the bottom 25% of our entire state. Now, we can just simply ignore that and say, hey, this was a test. Let's not look at that. But you know what? I think that school system needs a good hard look.
But for School Boards Association head Andrea Messina, the issue isn't about scores or punishment. It's an issue of credibility. And she says she's not alone.
So it's not just the education community that recognizes the problem, and that's why we have such great concern about the credibility of the entire system, because everyone says, slow down a minute, things just don't seem right.
The Superintendents Association is asking for new legislation to take a step back and reevaluate. The proposed changes would mean insulating schools from poor scores and revamping the accountability system. No bill has been filed yet, but the plans could find a supporter in Bill Montford.
Let's take a look at the recommendations that have been made. How can we implement those and get them in place by the 2016 administration of the FSA? But we can't be punitive. We've got to do it right. Our students deserve that. Teachers deserve that. Our communities deserve that. And it's too important for us to not have confidence in the accountability system.
Educators agree that the accountability system needs to be addressed, but with no such bills yet filed for the upcoming session, they'll have to wait and see what lawmakers have in mind. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, this July brought changes to Florida's craft distilling industry. New laws loosened regulations to allow more flexibility in person-to-person sales. But as Nick Evans reports, some distillers hope those changes are just the first step.
So that's some whiskey that you can see the color. I mean, it's amazing. Look at that color. This is rum. This rum was in here for about 30 days.
Phil McDaniel, head of St. Augustine Distillery.
Yeah, we've been in the planning stages for 5 years. We've been in operations and open to the public since March of 2014, so a little over 18 months.
It's probably best known for vodka, but they make gin, rum, and their first batch of bourbon is stacked 6 barrels high in the warehouse. But compared to some operations, St. Augustine is tiny. Take the bottling process. Instead of those mammoth conveyor systems that crank out a couple million cans of beer a day, the distillery has Leanne Howland.
And then once they're full, we cork them.
She's bottling gin, six at a time, and the entire process, from empty bottle to labeled, sealed product, happens on a single table, maybe 6 feet long.
We can do about 40 cases, 20 cases an hour, about 150 cases a day.
Spirits have not really been an industry in Florida ever. I mean, craft spirits anyway, have not existed here for very long. There's only a handful of distillers.
Beer and wine are bigger industries and tend to get more attention in state politics. But McDaniel says distillers notched a big win earlier this year.
The law that passed this last session effectively allows a craft distiller, and a craft distiller is defined as any licensed distiller who produces less than 75,000 gallons a year, which is very small, you know, compared to a large distillery. We can sell now up to 2 bottles per brand per person per year.
Before that, the limit was 2 bottles per person per year.
And now with this new law change, we could sell 2 bottles of gin, 2 bottles of vodka, 2 bottles of rum.
And McDaniel says the immediate impact has been pretty surprising.
From our bottom line, our sales have been up 15%. Or maybe even 18% as a result since July 1st. And that's significant. And, you know, we hope over time we can demonstrate to our distributor partners and our retail partners that the more product we can sell from here, the better it is for them, because ultimately that will lead to future consumers.
But making that case could be difficult. McDaniel is hoping to eventually remove any limit on in-person sales, but he and other distillers are likely to face significant pushback from those partners in the distribution and retail industries. Florida regulates alcohol by forcing it through a 3-tier system, where producers sell to distributors who then sell to retailers. And although McDaniel's sales today may boost business for those other tiers down the road, those other tiers are more concerned they're losing out on money today.
We've tackled several issues, y'all know, that are relating to alcohol. I will tell you now, I think we're going to tackle several more again this year that may be highly contentious that are regarding alcohol. Matter of fact, if I was a betting man, I would bet on it.
This is Halsey Bashiers, the Monticello Republican who chairs the House Business and Professions Subcommittee. Those contentious measures could include proposals for powdered alcohol and the so-called Whiskey and Wheaties Bill, aimed at allowing grocers to sell alcohol without setting up a separate store. But it's likely they'll also revisit bottle restrictions. Sarasota Republican Representative Greg Stube is sponsoring the bill.
And so I'll be filing another bill this year that will repeal that prohibition completely, so it wouldn't be 2 bottles per person this or 2 bottles per brand or whatever the case may be. It'll be if you as an individual go to that place of business and you're of age and you want to purchase a case of whiskey or a case of whatever it is, then you should have the ability to do that.
Stube filed that measure late last month. If McDaniel gets his way, it'll take effect next July. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.